From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Rion Malan's great-uncle was the chief architect of South Africa's apartheid system. Malan left South Africa in 1977. He was unwilling to pick up a gun to support apartheid and fight in the army, and he was unwilling to pick up a gun for the resistance. On today's Fresh Air, Malan discusses his return to South Africa. Also today, actor Kurtwood Smith tells us what it's like to always get the role of the bad guy. He was the psychopunk in RoboCop, the corrupt DA in True Believer, and a repressive father in Dead Poets Society. Rock historian Ed Ward introduces us to the man behind many of the Philly Sound's biggest hits. And book critic John Leonard reviews Germaine Greer's new memoir about her father. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Senate today unanimously approved limited economic sanctions against China for its crackdown on the pro-democracy movement. The legislation is now on its way to President Bush for his signature. Bush vetoed the same bill in November because of objections to an unrelated legislative restriction resulting from the Iran-Contra scandal. The House stripped the offending section from the bill and sent it to the Senate. The White House began the job of selling its fiscal 1991 budget directly to Congress today. The head of the Office of Management and Budget, Richard Darman, appeared before the House Budget Committee, where he defended his budget against a barrage of criticism from Democrats. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Democrats said the budget was filled with gimmicks and lies. They complained that the $1.23 trillion spending plan cuts defense too little, domestic spending too much, and that it relies on economic assumptions about growth that are too optimistic. Darman defended his creation, pointing out that OMB's assumptions about the economy had been right last year. As far as gimmicks were concerned, Darman said, Congress had agreed to all of them. When asked why the administration didn't take advantage of the thaw in the Cold War to make big cuts in the military budget and apply them to the deficit, or take advantage of the president's high popularity ratings to make other bold moves on revenues or spending, Darman responded by saying the president is popular because people prefer small steps to big ones. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The head of the House Armed Services Committee predicted today that Congress will cut troops and at least some B-2 stealth bombers from what he called President Bush's fairly timid defense budget. Democrat Les Aspin also accused Bush of putting a political gun to congressmen's heads by proposing cuts at military bases in their home districts. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan today told a congressional committee the current slowdown in the economy is only temporary. NPR's John Itzde has more.
Despite the slow growth in the U.S. economy in the final 3 months of 1989, Greenspan said statistical analysis shows that chances of the country slipping into a recession have actually declined since last spring. But Greenspan said more data was needed before it can be known for certain whether the economy is pulling out of its decline. The Federal Reserve chairman also said that last year's rate of inflation, about 4.5%, was too high. And he said, investors' fears that inflation will not come down further are keeping long-term interest rates high. Greenspan's comments on inflation were read by analysts as an indication that the Federal Reserve would not move to lower interest rates soon, an action that could spur economic activity but also fuel inflation. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 10 points today to close at 2543.24. Declines led advances 3-1. This is NPR News. A federal trial is underway in Atlanta for a racial discrimination lawsuit that legal observers say is the first of its kind. Ed Hula reports.
Both plaintiff and defendant in this lawsuit are black, but Tracy Lynn Morrow says because of her light complexion, her darker-skinned supervisor fired her in 1986 from a clerk typist job at the IRS in Atlanta. The supervisor and the IRS say Morrow was fired for insubordination and unsatisfactory job performance. Morrow's attorney plans to present scholars to testify that prejudice among American blacks based on skin shade has existed since the days of slavery. Last May, federal judge Charles Moy ruled that Morrow's lawsuit seeking lost wages and back pay was covered under civil rights law. Judge Moy began hearing testimony today. The non-jury trial is expected to be over by week's end. For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hula in Atlanta.
An Illinois woman was found guilty of murder today in the suffocation of one of two infant daughters she claimed were abducted 3 years apart by a masked man. Paula Marie Sims was convicted in the April 29th death of her six-week-old daughter, Heather Lee. Prosecutors have said they would seek the death penalty. At least six more people, including a policeman, were reported killed in clashes in Yugoslavia's Kosovo province today over demands by ethnic Albanians for political reforms. It brought the death toll after a week of riots to 22. Paramilitary police forces battled thousands of ethnic Albanians throughout the province today, using clubs and spraying crowds with tear gas from helicopters. The United States said today it has protested the intimidation of the opposition groups in Romania. And officials say a visit to Bucharest next week by Secretary of State James Baker is in doubt. The news comes as the State Department also announced a one-day delay in Baker's scheduled meeting with Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rian Milan, was born into a family that played a key role in the development of South Africa's system of apartheid. His ancestors were among the original Dutch trekkers who settled in South Africa. His great-uncle, Daniel Milan, was the principal architect of apartheid and became the first Afrikaner nationalist prime minister. Rian Milan is at odds with his heritage. He opposes apartheid. He left his country in 1977 and returned in 1985 with the intention of writing a book. Milan had been a police reporter in South Africa and a journalist in the U.S. His new memoir is My Traitor's Heart, A South African Exile Returns to Face His Country, His Tribe, and His Conscience. In his book, Milan says that his father had the uncanny ability to discern a moral purpose to apartheid.
Well, I guess my father believed in something called separate but equal. I think he convinced himself that ethnocentricity was such a powerful force that people of various races and cultures couldn't actually get along together, and that it was in everyone's best interests that whites and blacks in South Africa be separate but equal. This was essentially a self-serving delusion. Separate but equal, as it did in the in the south of the United States, meant subjugation for the black man. In the final analysis.
Did you grow up accepting that?
You know, I don't think I ever really accepted it. I'm not sure I can tell you why, but I mean, I have this very early memory of being in our family station wagon and my father turning to me. We were in a filling station. My father turned to me and said, ask the boy to pump the back tire or something. And I leant out the window and I was going to call this grown African man a boy, and it seemed to me, it suddenly struck me for some reason that this was an impolite thing to do and that I should actually call him sir. And so thereafter, that's more or less what I did. I'm not suggesting that I was more enlightened or anything than the rest of my tribe, but, maybe we're all like that in the beginning. I mean, all Afrikaans children are brought up by black people, and I think it's impossible for that sort of, if you love the people who raise you.
You say that when you were 16, you became a communist, you were also a hippie, and that you thought that growing long hair and reading Tolkien and spraying slogans on walls in the suburbs would undermine apartheid. It seems to me you're very cynical looking back at that period, thinking that you were rebelling more against strict school discipline than you were against the apartheid system.
We must understand that white South Africa is, in many respects, it's this sort of generically Western, whites-only moon base in Africa. We had no real understanding of the fact that we lived in Africa. We had no real grasp of what it was to be black under apartheid. So we took our cues, by and large, from the sort of things that you as an American might have taken from. I mean, my father, for example, subscribed to Time and Life. Used to read them from cover to cover every week. My greatest hero in the world was Bob Dylan. And so I guess that we saw ourselves as the protagonists in a sort of worldwide drama. It was the drama of student rebellion in the late 60s and early 70s, where growing your hair long was a revolutionary act. I don't think I'm cynical about it in retrospect so much as it just seemed silly to me, especially considering where we lived.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the slogans you used to spray on walls was "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud." And you said you'd never really heard the James Brown song, but you knew the title from skimming through Time magazine, and that it was very hip when you were a teenager for suburban white teenagers to be into black culture, but not black African culture, just black American culture. What kinds of things got through? what aspects of black American culture were you into, and why was it American and not African?
Well, once again, because we lived in the sort of framework of Western culture. I tell the story in the book about playing in a blues band, which my name was Milan, and two of the guys in the band were Afrikaners, too. But the music, we played Howlin' Wolf songs and Sonny Boy Williamson songs, and we considered, there we were playing the blues at segregated garage parties in John Foster's South Africa at the apogee of the apartheid era, and nobody laughed at us. Why? Because all our compadres on the moon base didn't know that they were in Africa, too. It was a curious sort of manifestation, but... yes. Well, I mean, for example, we all knew the words of "We Shall Overcome" and so forth off by heart, but I don't think very few of us could so much as hum the tune of "Nkosi Sikelele Afrika," which was the African national anthem. That's how it was to grow up in white South Africa.
Was this strictly a white liberal phenomenon in South Africa?
I think it's a phenomenon that was confined largely to the liberal enclaves, the sort of middle and upper middle class enclaves of the big white cities. I think a lot of us had this fantasy that it was our destiny in life to lead black people to the barricades and to freedom. But the important concept there was that we would be leaders. And I think that what we had in mind was sort of middle class managerial positions, much like the ones that our father owned, that our fathers held, rather. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that Steve Biko was reacting to when he founded the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa, was this assumption on the part of white liberals that we knew what was best for blacks.
My guest is Rion Milan, and his ancestors were among the original Dutch trekkers who settled in South Africa. His new memoir is called My Traitor's Heart, A South African Exile Returns to Face His Country, His Tribe, and His Conscience. You became a journalist, and you call journalism, with some cynicism, I think, the liberal calling. What do you mean when you say that?
If you were a young white South African, you wanted to do something about the country, about the way things were in the country, but you weren't necessarily that committed, that you wanted to go off and join the military wing of one of the exiled revolutionary movements. The next best thing, at least in my youth, was becoming a reporter in one of Johannesburg's liberal English newspapers. It offered you the chance to make an approximately comfortable living and at the same time strike blows against the Boers.
Now, you became a crime reporter.
That's correct.
And you say you studied how South Africans kill each other. Do you think that the crime beat offered certain clues to the South African psyche?
Well, I think it put me into situations that most South Africans, irrespective of their politics, would never normally go into. For example, as the crime reporter, one of my duties was to maintain a relationship with the secret police. So once every 10 days or 2 weeks or so, I'd pay a courtesy call on the colonels on the 10th floor of the Blue Hotel, which was police quarters and headquarters in Johannesburg. And so I'd find myself drinking tea with such really notorious South Africans as Roy Rus Swanepoel. That means the Red Russian Swanepoel, so named for his tendency to find a Russian under every bed. Anyway, Swanepoel had previously been the chief interrogator of the security police. He interrogated Winnie Mandela during her 17 months in solitary confinement in 1969. And he was absolutely notorious man whose mere name struck terror into the heart of any black political activist. I met him. I think anyone who's working the labor beat or the political beat would not have. You had to be working the police beat to meet such men. And then, of course, as a crime reporter, one of my briefs was to cover crime in Soweto. And Soweto was a place where it had an astronomical crime rate. And I guess whenever I went on tours of Soweto police stations to win friends and influence people and make contacts among the white commanders of those stations, they'd always assume that as a representative of the English-speaking liberal press, I was in need of some brutal doses of reality, and they'd often give them to me, and brutal they were.
You must have had something of a dual personality while covering the crime beat. I'm sure the name Milan helped you make contacts with the police. And on the other hand, when you were in the townships, I'm sure it's not a name that you offered too freely to the black people that you were writing about.
Strange that you should mention that. I often used to use, I used to tell people my name was John Black under certain circumstances and certain times. It seemed prudent to do so. But yes, no, I did have a split personality, and as I sit here, I think I still have one. It always seemed to me that there were always two aspects to my personality. I was an Afrikaner who despised what whites had done to blacks in my country. You know, on the other hand, I was a white who was apprehensive of Africans and was scared whenever he went into Soweto. I would not have said so then. I guess I can say so now.
Well, you were, I think, scared for a couple of reasons when you'd go into Soweto. One was that as a white person you felt like a target, and you understood why there was such hatred towards whites by blacks. On the other hand, you thought that some of your fear was based in racism, based on this just kind of unnameable fear of black people that you were brought up with. How could you distinguish between the two and purge yourself of the racism while understanding when it was appropriate to be afraid?
Well, I don't know. I think that's a question that I've wrestled with my entire life and that I'll probably continue to wrestle with the rest of my life. A lot of the fear of the whites have for Africans in South Africa is clearly phantasmagoric. I tell the story in my book of a night when I went drinking in Soweto with a friend of mine. We had several drinks too many, and we fell into conversation with some guys who were they were giving voice to, I guess, a pretty common sentiment in Soweto at that time in the midst of the Greist Uprising. They were telling me that every white they saw was an enemy to them and so forth. And I had an acute attack of paranoia, so I decided I had to get out of there before somebody attacked me, and I went off walking through the streets of Soweto alone on foot. Now, it might sound like an ordinary thing to you to do. It struck me I felt as though I was walking on the moon. And I was quite certain that I'd never reach my car alive. I was in a state of acute terror. And my terror reached a crescendo when somebody tapped on my shoulder, and I spun around, and here was one of the guys who I was sure was plotting to murder me, tapping me on the shoulder with a big smile on his face and said, "Listen, brother, it's not safe for you to be here alone. We'll walk with you." And so there I was, revealed for what I was, a white man beset by, I suppose, what I describe in the book as racist misgivings.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. We'll talk about your leaving South Africa, your return, and then your leaving again. My guest is Rian Milan, and his ancestors were among the original Dutch trekkers who settled in South Africa. His great-uncle was the principal architect of the present system of apartheid. Milan, who opposes apartheid, has written the new book, My Traitor's Heart, A South African Exile Returns to Face His Country, His Tribe, and His Conscience. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Rian Milan is my guest. You left South Africa in 1977. You say you were scared of the coming changes and scared of the consequences of not changing.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you leave?
Well, if you'd met me as I disembarked from a plane in London, I would have told you that I was dodging the draft and that I was a noble and principled sort of human being who was not prepared to carry a gun for apartheid. The truth of the matter is I left for the reasons that you just stated. I saw cataclysm of some sort rather looming ahead in South Africa, and I didn't want to be part of it. I didn't know which side I was on. I ran away.
Mm-hmm. So you felt like you, on the one hand, didn't fully support apartheid, on the other hand, you weren't ready to join the resistance.
Yes, that's about it, yes.
You returned to South Africa after working as a journalist in the States in 1985. Why did you go back?
I guess essentially because my exile had become unbearable and because momentous events were underway in South Africa and I wanted to be there. And finally, just because I'd always felt diminished by running away, I felt that I had to go back to redeem myself as a as an Afrikaner maybe, but just especially as a human being, I didn't feel, I wasn't at ease with my conscience.
Do you think of yourself as still being in the center between the pro-apartheid Afrikaners and the resistance?
I don't see any other place for myself. I believe in democracy, right? And I also believe in the free enterprise system. Believing in democracy, on the one hand, puts me at odds with people who support the ruling power, the ruling party in South Africa at this juncture. And my belief in the free enterprise system makes me something of a pariah with the forces to the left, the revolutionary movements, the liberation movements, both of whom have as a central article of faith the imposition of a socialist system in South Africa. And at this juncture of history, I just don't think that I don't think socialism can do the things that people in South Africa are hoping it will. I mean, South Africa has to create 3,000 to 5,000 jobs a day between now and the turn of the century in order to keep black unemployment and misery at its present untenable level. And I simply don't believe that a socialist system could do that. I think that the wise policy to pursue is to encourage as much foreign investment in the country as possible, and at the same time try and generate tax revenues that could be used to address and ameliorate the bottom line sufferings of black people, to provide housing and food and free education and the other things that are on the liberation movement's agenda.
Working with the press in South Africa, you say that there were things that made you very uncomfortable about how both the South African and the American press covered issues in South Africa, that there were things that you thought liberal journalists were so uncomfortable with that they didn't bother to report. What's an example?
One which I mentioned in my book and which actually changed my life was the way the New York Times covered South Africa on April 15, 1986. Top of the news from South Africa that day, as far as the Times is concerned, was Desmond Tutu's election as Archbishop of Cape Town and hence head of the Anglican Church in South Africa. New York Times devoted quite a lot of space to Bishop Tutu's speech, in which was replete with noble ideas and also to things which I as a liberal would agree. And underneath the story about Bishop Tutu was a tiny headline reading 11 die overnight. Six black people had been burned to death under circumstances no white reporter would ever inquire into, and five had been shot by the police. And then finally, underneath that, there were these two tiny cryptic little paragraphs, unheralded by any headline, about something which I found sort of very hard to understand. The discovery in a place called Sekhukhuniland of the bodies of 32 African women who had been suspected of using witchcraft to retard the freedom struggle and thus incinerated in the name of fundamental change. It was clearly the ash pits of Sekhukhuniland were a site from which the New York Times chose to avert its eyes. On the other hand, in South Africa, you must understand that events like that are played up by the state-controlled media, electronic media, and to a certain extent by the rest of the press. And they detonate like dynamite in fearful white psyches and tend to intensify the fears that essentially hold white South Africa together. I don't think that overlooking them really helps Americans achieve any sort of understanding of how South Africa works.
When did you go back to the States after returning to South Africa?
I came back towards the middle of 87.
So you were gone about 2 years?
Yes.
And why did you decide to leave South Africa and come back, well, to leave your home in South Africa and come back to the States?
Because I felt that I needed to achieve some distance from the things that I was trying to write about. And the nature of South Africa, the nature of living in South Africa, you tend to change your mind every day. One day you'll open a newspaper and there'd be, for example, stories of secret police hit squads killing activists in the townships for no reason. That'd make you feel one way and draw certain conclusions. And the next day, it'd be something like the witch burnings that I just mentioned, which would cause you to veer in a completely different direction. So I seem to spend all my days in South Africa bobbing up and down on, the cross of ambiguities. I felt as though I needed to achieve some distance in order to write the book that I wanted to.
Well, the book's written. Are you going to go back?
Yes.
When?
when this book tour is over, when I face the music.
Some Americans might read your book as almost a liberal apology for the continued white government in South Africa, saying, well, listen, things are less clear-cut than they seem. Things are more complicated. Mm. There's a lot of black-on-black crime that isn't covered as well in the American press. There's atrocities on both sides. Is this a message you're trying to bring?
Well, I think it's a message that my book does carry. Trying, yes. Well, I think people go beyond that. I think that a lot of people are going to say my book is reactionary. And in some way it is. I mean, at one stage I was so angry with the way that America was covering South Africa, or rather not covering certain things that happened in it, that I spoke of wanting to leap off the page and tear out the throat of the nearest enlightened white man. I don't know who it behoves to look away when black people kill each other. I think it serves only the sense of self-righteousness of people who'd like to think that South Africa is a very simple country. It doesn't help the people who live in it, and doesn't help those who die in that kind of violence. I mean, you're probably aware, since you seem to know South Africa quite well, that there's this terrible civil war underway within the Zulu nation. A war that's claimed about 2,500 lives in the last 3 years. And this war just doesn't get covered by anyone at all. I mean, why is this? The social fabric of the Zulu nation is disintegrating in those townships. You drive through them and some of them look like Berlin after World War II. And it's not a story. I don't know.
What's your relationship like now with your family?
It's much better than it was when I was a teenager. I'm still regarded, I think my father is still rather suspicious of my politics. So is my brother. But at least we talk to each other.
Coming from a family that not only supported but created apartheid,
mm-hmm.
do you feel that you have the ability to really understand the people who still uphold the system, who are perhaps willing to give away a few of their benefits, but who basically still uphold apartheid? Do you feel like you have special insight into how they operate, what motivates them?
To a certain extent, yes. I think one of the sub-themes in my book is that I'm united with them in only, if only in this respect, is that I would acknowledge my own fear of what lies ahead in the country and arguably of majority rule. I think that white South Africans are best understood as a nation of paranoics, stranded on a desert island in the midst of what they believe to be a shark-infested sea. They're reluctant to set foot in the water and to submerge themselves in the water because they fear what might happen to them there. And so long as I was prey to that fear too, so long as I had questions about what lay ahead, it seems to me that I would be lying if I didn't say I was one of them. I am one of them.
Well, Rion Milan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Rion Milan's new book is My Traitor's Heart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk about musicals with Arthur Lawrence. He wrote the books for West Side Story and Gypsy, and he directed the current Broadway revival of Gypsy, starring Tyne Daly. This is Angela Lansbury from the 1973 London production, which Lawrence also directed.
Some people can get a thrill knitting sweaters and sitting still. That's okay for some people who don't know they're alive. Some people can thrive and bloom living life in the living room. That's perfect for some people of 105. But
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In RoboCop, he was a sadistic killer. In True Believer, he was a corrupt DA. In Dead Poets Society, he was a repressive father. And on One Cable miniseries, he was Joseph Goebbels. Coming up, we ask actor Kurtwood Smith why he never seems to play a well-adjusted guy. Also, rock historian Ed Ward introduces us to Tom Bell. He's the producer behind hits by the Stylistics, the Delphonics, and the Spinners. And book critic John Leonard reviews Daddy, We Hardly Knew You. It's writer Germaine Greer's memoir about her father and her investigation into his mysterious past. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Senior American officials and diplomats in Moscow are playing down rumors that Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev is considering resigning as head of the Soviet Communist Party. Secretary of State James Baker says the reports of such a move are just rumors. Thane Gustafson is a professor of government at Georgetown University. He says that if the rumors are true, a Gorbachev resignation as party chief would carry a strong message for both Soviet bureaucrats and Soviet citizens.
He would be sending a very strong signal top to bottom throughout the country at a time when 75% of the population is getting set to vote in elections for the local parliaments on March 4th. What he would be saying is the old party system is gone. It's over. And all you bureaucrats and party apparatus people out there, don't count on me to be the party boss anymore. I am staking my future on the new order.
The world's financial markets reacted to today's rumors. The price of the dollar soared today. A special session of the Communist Party's Central Committee has been called for next week. For the last 8 days, the province of Kosovo in southern Yugoslavia has been the scene of violent street clashes between security forces and thousands of ethnic Albanians. Pierre Vickery reports from Zagreb.
Two more ethnic Albanians have been killed by police during street fighting, bringing the reported death toll in Kosovo to 18. Security forces were rushed to one town to prevent clashes between Albanian Muslims and Orthodox Christian Serbs. Tension has also been heightened by the Slovene decision to withdraw its entire peacekeeping contingent by this weekend and to cut all funds for security in Kosovo. Two Yugoslav ministers have arrived in the regional capital for talks aimed at starting a dialogue between the combatants. But the Serbian communists have refused all compromise and have described the federal government's plans to open talks with the Albanians as obscene. For National Public Radio, I'm Pierre Vickery in Zagreb, Yugoslavia.
Senate Democrats today proposed a $500 million aid package to foster emerging democracies in Eastern Europe. The package is $200 million more than what has been suggested by President Bush. The measure would provide funds in addition to the $738 million in aid already approved for Poland and Hungary. The additional $511 million would be targeted at Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Romania, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia. Five small earthquakes struck the desert in Southern California within 2 hours this morning. Seismologists say that none of the quakes measured more than 2.9 on the Richter scale. The epicenter was 25 miles north of El Centro. Stock prices were lower on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 10 points to close at 2543.24. Declines led advances. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says that in the 1970s, Tom Bell almost single-handedly defined the sound of sophisticated soul music. Bell was a producer, but Ed says it was Bell's arrangements that really made people listen.
Tom Bell is an odd guy in many ways, and one thing nobody's really sure of is when exactly he was born. It was around 1940 in Philadelphia, and when he was about 19, he joined a doo-wop group called the Romeos with his friend Kenny Gamble. Like Gamble, Bell knew that the future for him lay in the studio. So after quitting the Romeos, he became a session musician, learning the business from the trenches. His first success as an arranger came in 1968 with a record by the Showstoppers called Ain't Nothin' But a House Party, which went on to be a big hit in England and a minor success over here. Not long afterwards, he was called upon by another Philly group, the Delphonics.
Many guys have come to you with a line that wasn't true, and you passed them by.
As you can hear on this, the Delphonics' very first record, Bell got a lot from a little. A tiny string section, a small rhythm section, and some percussion all gave a silky veneer, but the drums and vocals were right up front. So, a couple of years later, when he'd established himself as the man who'd made the Delphonics, he could take a bit more and make it sound huge.
I gave my heart and soul.
If you listened carefully, you noticed that there weren't that many instruments, but at a climactic moment, there was one very complex chord masked by a lot of echo that gave a truly symphonic effect. Bell's next triumph was the Stylistics, another Philadelphia-based harmony group whose lead singer, Russell Tompkins Jr., sang in a voice that was just this side of a squeak.
If I could, I'd like to be a great big movie star.
By this time, Bell was an industry unto himself. He arranged, conducted, and produced the Stylistics records, and co-wrote many of their best numbers with his longtime companion, a French woman named Linda Creed. By 1972, he was up to a real challenge. He took on a group that had been hanging around Motown Records forever, and had finally been released from their contract, and, on the strength of his reputation, got them a deal with Atlantic. Their first collaboration hit gold. Between 1972 and 1978, the Spinners put 18 records arranged and produced by Tom Bell on the pop charts. Bell, using many of the same studio musicians, gave his old friend from the Romeos, Kenny Gamble, and the guy who'd replaced Bell in the group, Leon Huff, some strong competition. The Philadelphia sound, on the one hand, was the Stylistics and the Spinners, and on the other hand, the OJs, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and the Intruders at Gamble and Huff's Philadelphia International label. I have no idea why, but Bell mostly kept away from Gamble and Huff, although he did arrange the OJ's immortal hit, Love Train. But as the 70s wore on, disco became more mechanical, and the Philadelphia sound faded slowly from the charts. Tom Bell went into semi-retirement on his farm near Seattle, although he did record an EP with Elton John that included the hit Mama Can't Buy You Love in 1979, and the next year found him producing this masterpiece for Denise Williams.
It's not another song.
Linda Creed died last year, but Bell occasionally shows up as producer for one of the many fine harmony groups who continue to record. I hope he keeps it up for a long time to come.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. It took the role of a sadistic cop killer in the 1987 film RoboCop to turn around the career of character actor Kurtwood Smith. Since then, he's gotten critical attention for two other villainous roles, the corrupt district attorney in True Believer and the rigid father in Dead Poets Society. In this scene from RoboCop, Smith, in the role of Clarence, taunts Peter Weller, who plays the cop.
Well, what have we here? You a good cop? Hot shot? I'm sure you are. Why, you gotta be some kind of great cop. Come in here all by yourself. You probably don't think I'm a very nice guy. Do you?
Buddy, I think you're slime.
See, I got this problem. Cops don't like me, so I don't like cops. Well, give the man a hand.
Did you like the part as written? Did you make any changes in it?
Oh, we made a lot of changes, primarily dialogue changes, sort of as we, you know, that was sort of as we went along. I think that as the shooting progressed, I got more and more comfortable with the character, and I don't think the character was as funny and didn't have nearly as many sort of what you would call catchphrases when we initially started out. And a lot of those sort of came out of the situation.
Well, let me ask you about one line. Toward the beginning of the movie, when you shoot Peter Weller's hand off, this is before he becomes RoboCop, when he's just a cop, you shoot his hand off and then you say, well, give this man a hand.
Yeah.
Is this
one
of your lines?
Yes, actually, that was something that came out when we were rehearsing it. And then Paul liked it quite a bit, so he put it in. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was almost over the top when I said it. I said it as kind of a joke, and then he thought it fit in perfectly. And it is a line that gets mentioned a lot in reviews and articles about myself. People seem to. I guess it was such a shocking line at that particular point, and in a lot of ways, sort of set the tone for my character and the other bad guys as well in that film.
You're knifed in the neck at the end of the movie. That's how you're killed, and the blood spurts out. It spurts like inches away from your neck. It's really like a fountain. Can you tell us how the special effects for that works? Like where's the blood vial, and how do you get it to start spurting after your knife?
Well, there was a tube that ran down the sleeve of my jacket, and then down through my pants legs, and then into the water, and out at the water's edge, there was a special effects guy with a tank. And So that basically when he stabbed me, I grabbed my throat, and then the guy would just start pumping blood through this thing, and it would just come jutting out in between my fingers. God, it sounds so gruesome. I guess it looked pretty gruesome, too. But at the time, I didn't think about it too much because there were so many sort of technical things involved, you know, not falling down in the water too soon and making sure that, that I was turned right so that the camera could see the blood. It was all sort of very technical. And then when you see it in the film, it looks pretty ghastly.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference, do you think, between a hack action film and a really good one? And I think RoboCop is really a fine film. There's really good performances in it. It's funny. It's entertaining. It has a sense of irony about itself.
Well, I think that you just sort of said one of the differences between, you know, one of the major differences between a hack action film and a film like RoboCop. RoboCop had something more to say. A hack action movie is something that just relies entirely on its action and violence, usually. Or in the sense of a comedy, just pure out action. I think that with RoboCop there was a theme to the movie that had to do with sort of the endurance of the human spirit. And then beyond that, there were a lot of sort of political jokes, social satire. And then, of course, there was a lot of humor in regards to American corporate big business.
What were the immediate effects of RoboCop on your career?
Well, I had a lot of people, you know, prior to RoboCop, I was always trying to find a job, any kind of job, in film and television. And after RoboCop, people were trying to get me to work for them. So, I think that's the main change.
Another role I want to ask you about is as a very rigid father in Dead Poets Society, a father who treats his family as if he's running the military, and it leaves the son absolutely no freedom for the son to develop his own individuality or to follow his own desires. This showed a different facet of your acting. So someone who's rigid as opposed to flamboyantly sadistic,
mm-hmm.
or terribly corrupt.
Yeah. That character. I always had a great deal of sympathy for that man, simply because when I first read the script, and I think when people see the film, they don't, you know. So that what I found was necessary for me to play the part, and in order for the part to work within the film, and therefore for the film to work as a whole, that the character believe very strongly that what he is doing is right, and right for the boy's sake as opposed to being right for his sake. In other words, I think that Mr. Perry felt very, very, very deeply that he was attempting to save his son from an unpleasant life. You know, they had always had a sort of deal between the two of them as to what the son's future would be, what his plans were, that he was going to go to the academy, and then he was going to go on to one of the prep schools, to one of the Ivy League schools, and then, you know, become a doctor or a lawyer, and live that kind of life. So that when this business develops in the film, the father assumes that the son has, in a sense, gone off the deep end, and since he's always been such a good kid, there must be other reasons for this, and the only way to stop this is to take some kind of a strong hand.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're the only person I've ever heard of with the first name of Kurtwood, which I understand is a name that your mother basically invented for you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she liked the name Kurt, and but she thought it was too short to go with Smith. So she had spent her honeymoon in Kirkwood, Louisiana, and she didn't like the name Kirk, but she liked Kurt, so she just kind of, you know, made it up. And it's been interesting. I was always Kurt up until I got involved in theater, and then although I used my full name on the program, people would always still call me Kurt until one summer I was working at Shakespeare Festival, and we had a Kent and a Chris and another Kurt and a Kirk, and So people started calling me Kurtwood, and then it just kind of stuck from, you know. But people usually mispronounce it. People usually assume it's Kirkwood. And one time I met, when I first came to Los Angeles, I met William Shatner, and he called me Curbwood, which was, I thought probably the most original mispronunciation of my name. But
this is a name I figure most people assume that you made up for the purposes of being an actor.
Sure. Yeah, that's why they always ask me about it. They assume it's a, you know, it's a stage name, but it's not. It's on my birth certificate.
Isn't this also the kind of name that's supposed to make it seem like you inherited a fortune?
Yeah, maybe that's part of it too. You know, maybe that's part of why we play a lot of these guys in suits and ties. You know, yeah, it does sound like that, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself differently as a person, having been cast in so many villainous type of roles?
Ooh, what a deep question. Do I see myself as a different person? Well, I think that I have tried to look at myself and try to figure out why people cast me, have a tendency to cast me in that. I don't really think that I have... changed as a person. I think that I can see why, you know, mainly I get cast or people show interest in me for those roles because I've done them well in the past. And that's something that you can't do much about that. I mean, that's certainly understandable. I mean, if you do it, you know, you do things well, then they want you to do that in their movie. I don't think that I have necessarily looked at myself and found darker aspects of myself that I didn't realize I had before. I mean, mm-hmm. is that what you're...
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Kurtwood Smith, we're out of time. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Kurtwood Smith's next film is Dinosaur, starring Gene Hackman and Mikhail Baryshnikov. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah. Are you taking a second look at the president's proposed budget?
You bet, Terry. More today on the fiscal 1991 budget starting in October. Budget Director Richard Darman has been selling the package up on Capitol Hill. And we'll talk with people in Charleston, Indiana, and in Britain about the proposed closing of military bases in their community. The cruise missile base at Greenham Common in Britain is especially interesting. There's been a nuclear weapons protest there for a long time now. The women who've been protesting now want the base to be completely dismantled. Also, some music from New York trumpet player Tom Harrell.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Germaine Greer's controversial book about feminism and sexuality, The Female Eunuch, made her something of a celebrity in the 1970s. Her new book is about her own family. Daddy, We Hardly Knew You is about Greer's search for the truth about her father's life. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
It's been 20 years since Germaine Greer pounced on us, out of Australia, with a ferocious grin. If in The Female Eunuch there wasn't much entirely new to readers of Simone de Beauvoir and Doris Lessing, Greer herself, vital and vulgar, stomping all over Sigmund Freud, was a tornado of fresh air. Trained in Melbourne and at Cambridge to be an academic, with a PhD in Shakespeare, she ran amok in the media streets. Down with marriage, down with morality, down with the state, she said. Pleasure seemed to be her only principle. 5 books, hundreds of interviews, and thousands of lectures later, Greer is back where she began, in Australia, doing what she probably should have done in The Female Eunuch, which is to inquire into the origin of her species. She's looking for her father. It's the oldest detective story in our literature. Think of Daddy, We Hardly Knew You as a radical feminist Oedipus. As detective stories go, it has its problems. She spent 3 years and thousands of dollars discovering the humdrum. Reg Greer, who looked like Basil Rathbone, who hated carrots and priests, and who worked, not very hard, as an advertising salesman for a Melbourne newspaper, had lied to his wife, to his daughter, and probably to himself, about himself. He hadn't been born a gentleman in South Africa and somehow fallen out of social grace into disappointment. Nor was he secretly Jewish. Nor had he suffered in the endless war from any romantic wounding or shell shock or brainwashing. Instead of descending from Scottish kings, he seems to have been the bastard son of a servant girl, to have been raised in a loving foster home in Tasmania and to have abandoned it without a backward glance, to have shirked his duties in the war as a cipher clerk at a decoding machine underground in Malta, and then again in India, to have been at the newspaper office a masher and a bounder. He didn't even know his own real name, though his daughter does. But in finding her father, Greer has lost her excuse. At her own decoding machine, she can't see why she should have had to have grown up in a house without music, books, flowers, cheese, or love. It was all phony, like his advertising. On the other hand, Greer discovered something more important. She discovered, first of all, Emma Greeny, her father's foster mother, who raised 27 children not her own, at least not biologically, who chose to make a family and a community out of the abandoned and the dispossessed, who knew in her bones, and I quote, that the doctrine of inherited moral defect was a doctrine of despair. Emma had an abundance, says Greer, all those human characteristics I most prize, tenderness, energy, intelligence, constancy, courage, compassion. She was true blue. And Greer also discovers herself, invents herself, in literature. On her quest, in England, Ireland, and Italy, all over Australia, in memory and the past, she reports on the weather of the heart, and she finds a transcendent language. Some of the most beautiful landscape in the world, she tells us, is man-made. The hill farms of Tuscany, the paddies of Nepal, the stone-walled fields of the British uplands. This woman-made humanscape is just as beautiful.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Daddy, We Hardly Knew You by Germaine Greer. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Arthur Lawrence. He wrote the books for the musicals Gypsy and West Side Story, and he directed the current Broadway revival of Gypsy, starring Tyne Daly. Also, Vietnam veteran Michael Norman tells us about his recent reunion with his war buddies. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Hearing later on from Shostakovich, his Symphony No. 15, and also some Russian cathedral music tonight. To start off, here's some music of the Baroque by Heinz Ignaz Franz von Bieber, a Bohemian-born musician who was particularly fond of writing for the violin. What we're going to hear is a work called Mensa Sonora, which has a much longer title, which translates as the sonorous table or instrumental table music with the lively sound of the